You're listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals with Decima Williams.
I want to turn then to South Africa to look at what has been achieved. I really want to underscore how visible is this critical mass that has emerged. And there are problems with it, but there are strengths. Let me say one of the problems first. That is, over the last, let's say, 40, 50 years, when the ANC in particular, but the mass democratic movement developed in the country, within the NGO sector, within the political movement, within the parties, within the communities, women played a critical role. And certainly that all occurred at a time at the international level, there was increase in consciousness and commitments to women's rights. And the South African democratic movement benefited from that. When, as the women tell me, victory was attained in 94, many of these structures lost their critical women who then went into government. And so I think we have to remember that. And that has weakened some of the organizations, some of the communities, some of the civil organizations. But it has strengthened the state and it has empowered women. We have to see what happens in the long haul. And as I said, 30% of the women in parliament, the three wives, the three Mandela women, Winnie Mandela, Graca Mandela, and Zanelli Mbeki, the new first lady, all three women at that tier are politically active in gender equity, consciousness raising, and programming. The Speaker of the House is a feminist of long standing and a democratic advocate of equally long standing. The Deputy Speaker of the House is also a militant from the ANC. The Deputy Leader of the Senate is also a woman of long standing political activism. So three of the major four leadership posts in the parliament are in their hands. And there are many, many structures. One count can give us up to 30. One critical one I want to mention is the Gender Equity Commission. Besides a statement in the Constitution about gender, race, equality, the Gender Commission is mandated to try to achieve gender equity through education and other means. And I think, in summary, what we can say is that at least the women whom I have interviewed do carry into their leadership positions a consciousness of where they have come from as women who were excluded from the society and take that as a moral mandate for how they govern. They've also undertaken initiatives at the legislative level to improve the material needs of women. I want to quote from the Minister of Housing, Sankey Mahanele, who said, "I wouldn't be proud if, as a woman minister involved in housing development, I would not, through my policies, begin to recognize the fact that I'm improving housing to all citizens of the country, in particular to women, who head up more than two-thirds of the households in South Africa, a sector of the population that is more than that of men, a sector in the population of people who have already made sure that the struggle is sustained through their contributions and through their work in their communities, also through their work in their families. I wouldn't be proud if I'm a minister of housing if I did not recognize and support them." And this is exemplary of the way most of the women whom I interviewed spoke. I quote also in terms of meeting material needs from Finnegan Waller, the Speaker of the House, who said, "I would like to see recognition of unpaid labor. It is unpaid work which adds significant value to our GDP. So I would like to see that as something we pursue much further. I would like to see a re-evaluation of jobs. For example, the lowest paid jobs in any society are what is described as women's work. It's jobs that women first went into because the skills they needed were similar to the skills they had or had acquired in the home. I want to see us start that, and we have begun that. We have begun that by requiring a new budget." They've also tackled with this new power, this critical mass power that they have, they've tackled sort of strategic gender transformation, strategic needs. I quote again from the Speaker of Parliament. She says, all parliaments are based on certain assumptions that it is gentlemen of leisure who are playing at politics as a part-time function. The assumption was that it was all male, certainly individuals who had no social responsibilities. Now you bring women into that institution and they can't cope. And then you say, see these women, we gave them a chance and they can't do it. We do not allow sessions after 6 or 7 o'clock in the evenings in this parliament. And the basis is not women. The basis is all members of parliament are entitled to a family life. She goes on to note that there's been a creche or a daycare center that have been brought in for all the children, workers, parliamentarians, journalists, all workers in the building are entitled access to the creche. I think what is important in my findings as I look at this transformation of women's power in the country in relation to the poverty and the homelessness and housing crisis and so on in the country, and ask myself, I mean, where do the two fit? Vivian Taylor, who is a member of the Gender Equity Commission, insisted to me that it's impossible to separate out the struggle for black feminism in South Africa with the struggle for democratic rule. Because, as she says, the apartheid state encroached into women's lives in a very personal way, directly into black family life. It regulated who you were to sleep with, where you were to work, where you were to get an education, if you were to get an education. And therefore, in reclaiming our personhood, we are reclaiming democracy. The challenge, I think, is to expand that so that this reclaiming that the politically astute women who now exercise power alongside their male counterparts have, that it reaches far and it reaches wide. Let me close by saying that the environment is changing. The environment in which women have and hold power, and at the same time, women, with the exercise of that power, changing the environment. Access to power is only part of the story. It's a necessary condition, but it's not a sufficient one. We now are moving as we must, if we are woman to woman, woman to society, change the conditions of exclusion and inequality. We must move from critical mass to critical consciousness to critical action. And it's not a task that can be done alone. It has been said that women should stop make history and make policy. I don't agree. I think in making policy, we make in history, and we should do more of that. Thank you.
I was very interested in your comments about what does it really mean for women at the bottom to have women in leadership at the top. And in a country like South Africa that has reached the quota of 30%, we hear often about the terrible rates of rape and violence against women. And I just wondered if you'd comment about, for the average, for the woman who's been raped in South Africa, what does it mean to have 30% of her representatives be women?
The sad truth is that among the women raped might be some of those 30%. So start with that, and that gives the 30% a direct experience, and they're not excluded from this reality of violence against women. But the fact that at a policy level, at an institutional framework level, there is a support for women's advancement that is not just stated, but is supported. Now, for the individual woman who is raped, the process may not reach her. Obviously, it hasn't. The education of men, you know, her own physical safety, maybe even the way she's treated in the police station. But I think all the women are concerned and alarmed about it and are positioned to move at a faster pace to do something if something can be done. unlike a situation where there is no interest or consciousness or it's swept under the table. Every policymaker, the Minister of Housing was particularly clear on that, and she said it means that in South Africa, we've got to bring more males into the conversation about women's rights. So it's one of those ironies. It really is, because at the same time that you see so many women emerging, this empowerment is expanding.
I'm so excited to hear that the Speaker of Parliament in South Africa, or that she's is a woman. And does she consider herself sort of an ambassador to women, and to the one who stands for women's issues? Or is she just like another member of Parliament, and where the different parties are squabbling against each other?
Yes. Two-part answer here. The first is that the woman herself, she's in her early 70s, let's say, was the very top-ranking diplomat for the ANC, long before the ANC had any diplomatic representation here in the West. Diplomat in the sense that she went underground and went to London to prepare the way for some of the leadership who eventually could leave the country, like Oliver Tambo and so. And has been, she's an Indian South African woman, part of the multiracial diversity there. She's a feminist legal scholar. She's a founding member of the All South African Women's Coalition. She is an advocate for women's rights every day of her life. She is, I think, very well known and respected in the country. And as I said, her deputy is also an ANC. You see, the ANC party adopted a quota of putting up 30% of its seats in the hands of women. So they have the largest, they have about 111 women in parliament of all ethnic class. I mean, it's a joyous thing to see. But to hear them and to see them work together also is quite a challenge across ethnicity, languages, politics, experiences, and so on. And I think that the Frene Greenwala is but one of a large core or critical mass of women who take women's rights seriously. And I must say that it's men and women. The policy statements that are made by the senior leadership are quite significant and by all accounts adhered to. Of course, again, some of my interviewees insisted that they always have to keep educating not only their men colleagues, but younger women who don't quite understand the struggle that was waged for this attainment, and so the culture might shift back again, as we've seen elsewhere.
Good evening. I'm Stuart Chong, recently from South Africa, retired anti-apartheid activist, and also was on the board of the Human Rights Committee of South Africa and worked with Archbishop Desmond Tutu for a number of years. I wanted to just comment in terms of your reference to the lone heroine and make reference to three organizations that come to my mind. One is really around a faith base of what is known in South Africa as the Mothers Union, mm-hmm. which were really the women who held the community together. Secondly, was an all-white women's organization called the Black Sash.
Yes, yes.
And lastly, and all these not wanting to detract from the individual's role and their own uniqueness, but the ANC Women's League, which really promoted the individual women into parliament, and just wanting to hear your comments on the three organizations and the roles they played in promoting women and women's roles.
Thank you. Well, women's rights have been on the agenda from, let's go back to 1956, with the militant stand that women took against the passbook. And Nelson Mandela paid tribute and going to pay tribute to them, said that when they saw the women in the thousands marching on Pretoria, on the Union Building, which was one of the most dreaded places you can go, when they saw the women marching and singing with Lillian Ngongi and these women who stood up and said, we are not carrying our passbooks, we will not be relegated by the state to subservience and so on. And it inspired the nation of the anti-apartheid movement, and they should be given credit. And in my a longer version of my paper, I chronicle that early history. Also, the ANC Women League, it must be remembered, with women like Albertina Sisulu and women too numerous to count, have been inside the country taking the blows and advancing the struggle when their organizations and their male leaders were banned. And that is also, it is in that context many of us became familiar with women like Mercy Sulu and Winnie Mandela and others. Even today, they continue to be a force. They defy the state because while the state, the courts, and the political apparatus have sanctioned Winnie Mandela, the ANC Women League, they continue to elect her president. Make what you want of that. Now, Black Sash is an organization which, as a predominantly white women's organization, had a voice in seeding and in carrying out, you know, this early liberal democratic alternative to apartheid. It was agitating for that at a time when radical voices were silenced inside the country. I think also the Mothers Union became eventually, if I'm correct, a version of the township militants, the women who said, we will make South Africa under apartheid ungovernable. We will not pay rent. We will not go to work when our children are sick. And they took up the popular grassroots democratic struggle in their day-to-day resistance. And they inspired, again, the women and men who were outside of the country at the UN or wherever it is they were. But they gave the agenda to the world by their insistence, and of course they paid a price for it. So there is that glorious history, and we must all pay tribute on August 9th. To South African Women's Day, which, you know, we've celebrated in the Caribbean for many years.
You spoke about, you know, the second model emerging, the critical mass. And I was just thinking of the situation here in Massachusetts. We have had three women elected to Congress in the whole of our history as a state. The last one was 16 years ago. Hmm. And because of the election that we had last year, we got two women elected statewide. And before that, we had just one woman, so it's like two-thirds of the women who have been elected to a statewide office in Massachusetts just happened in the last 6 months, if you would. And I'm just wondering, what are some of the lessons that maybe you could share with us, or some of the things that would help us here in Massachusetts to develop more of a critical mass horizontally so we can really affect the vertical? But in a sense, mm-hmm. just given especially, you know, the varied ethnicities that we have here in Massachusetts, the income, the different things that you spoke about, if there's some lessons that maybe you can share with us that might help us to keep hastening some of the work we've been doing since Beijing here. Thanks.
Clearly, you have to ask a difficult question. It seems to me that when we try to form coalitions, because in a sense that's what we are talking about, cross-class, cross-gender coalitions with a set of values that lead towards a more democratic social order. That's really what I'm looking at. And I think feminist energies in this sense of the Southern Hemisphere, I ask whether or not it's addressing. And how does one get that? I think we've got to, first of all, recognize differences among women. That woman doesn't give us just a homogeneous front, and we disguise our differences there, and therefore we can't really struggle and build alliance. So recognizing the difference and recognizing where the need is, which means recognizing our privilege and recognizing what we can do. I think there's a lot of silence. There's a relative silence about that in the North, at least in the U.S. I'm more familiar with the U.S. A relative silence. Okay, we've talked about race and so on, but we don't talk about class and inequality. And we have to stress that and use it as a platform for working together. We've got to be concerned about the structure that generates more and more inequality. We don't see it, most of us. We ignore it. And I think bringing our critical consciousness, you know, to what is desirable and having conversations about that is a way to bring around a coalition. The income inequalities, for example, in the state, the domestic violence, the conditions of immigrant women, on and on. If we put it all out on the table, we could begin to gather those of us who care enough to work together.
Yet another woman from the Caribbean, I'm afraid. Let me say thank you very much. It was all very useful and fascinating. I'm a fellow at the Kennedy School this term. When I'm not here, I'm a journalist. I'm from BBC Television in London, but more recently with CNBC Asia in Singapore. Let me pay tribute to the lady next to whom I was sitting, the erstwhile Prime Minister of Bermuda, Pamela Gordon.
Oh, Pamela Gordon,
and
is
now
here.
The leader of the opposition.
Hello, Pamela.
Who I think has a question as well.
Please stand, come and take a bow. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, I would like to take the opportunity, having been a leader of a country and a woman, to hopefully get you to take the opportunity now to step back for a moment and look at the likes of Benazir and a few others who you're concerned that they have not moved the woman's agenda as fast as you would like. Please bear in mind a very few important things. When a woman takes leadership of a country, first and foremost, she has to prove herself greater than any man would ever have to prove himself. And therefore, if she comes forward with women's agenda items, when there are other social issues that are pending, it is perceived that she is in the role out of context. Mm-hmm. Therefore, women have to gently be able to move forward with the social agenda of a given community, as well as be cognizant of the role of women, the concerns that the women have, and the ability to move their issues forward, without being seen as a feminist. And the reason for that is because it affects your credibility. So I would not be discouraged, nor would I be too willing to criticize the women who have not moved as quickly as you feel they should have, because it has been ominous when you stop and you look at the fact that men will criticize. We have come into what has been deemed to be a man's arena. And so for whatever success that we have made, I believe that we should celebrate those successes, recognizing that things move slowly, sometimes a little more slowly than we would like, but every success should be celebrated, and we recognize that every time you have a woman move forward. In Bermuda's case, in 97, leading up to the general election, we had Bermuda, I would say, would be a prime example. We had a woman Prime Minister and a woman opposition leader. We've now traded roles. We happen to have been the government for 30 years, and I think people wanted to see if the other side could ever govern. But we have a woman Attorney General, a woman mayor. I would say that pretty much most of our political side, we only have 20% women in our parliament. We have a 40-person parliament, 8 of them are women. But they have significant positions. And so it's important to ensure that we are prepared to celebrate our success, but women should be encouraged, and so should the men, because it should not be a separation of us and them, him versus her. It should be the fact that we have had some challenges in the past, and now that women are coming to the forefront, and they do bring a kinder, gentler, different perspective, maybe because of parenting or whatever, that we can move forward together with the men, not without them.
I want to both thank and celebrate you. Let me preface it by saying Bermuda, Ireland, Bangladesh are about the three countries where a woman was followed by another woman. Yes, and so it's becoming a bit of a norm. And I'm very happy to see you, Pamela. We do celebrate the fact that women arise. I think it is equally important for us to do the critical analysis, however, so that it is a way of strengthening the potential that we have for change. Women's acquisition of power at the executive parliamentary level, it's been seen as an end in itself, And when we celebrate it, clearly we signal that. But it has to be, to my mind, a means towards a larger game plan. It has to be a means of democratizing society, in gender terms, in other terms. It has to be a means through which we become, this equitable sharing of power between the genders become rather routinized. In fact, as the former premier said, social issues, and particularly women's issues of equality or opportunity, are seen as political non-starters for the politician. That you can't really deal with the tough issues of tourism or oil management or defense budget, whatever it is. And I think we have to be careful not to be drawn into this sort of false dichotomy and this false reality, because in fact, particularly in the period of globalization, issues of social expenditure, issues of democratic rights, in many ways, the real and overwhelming issues for all of society. Certainly in places where social exclusion for large numbers is really the challenge, whether it's, you know, unemployment, denial of material well-being, and so on. So that it remains a challenge for the woman politician to raise those issues that are central to the overall well-being of the nation, but to do so in a way that she is not seen as a sort of trivializing or marginalizing her power. We've got to educate all in society, particularly men, with power and in the sector, because most people understand unemployment. Most people understand the need for better wages and so on. It's not just for women, but it has been construed as women's work and women's issues, but it's really people's issues. And once we get that across, I think we have broken the barrier to the gender equality and sharing responsibilities.
Thank you all for your invaluable contributions to this conversation. And thank you, Desima, again.
You've been listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals, programming from the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. The Institute invites your comments on the series, Feminisms and the Practice of Democracy, via their website at www.radcliffe.edu/feminisms. The producer for this series is Laura Roscos, director of the Graduate Consortium in Women's Studies. Thank you for joining us.